Okay, it's 1 minute past two, so I think we'll get started. Could someone please message me in the chat to confirm that they can hear me? Awesome, thank you. And so just as a reminder, if you could try and make sure that your video is off and that you're on mute throughout, that would be very helpful. Welcome to the ninth weekly COVID-19 update. As a reminder, my name's Nick Matheson. I'm one of the PIs in CITID and also one of the infectious diseases consultants in the hospital. This week, I'm going to be joined by two of our infectious diseases registrars, Matt Routledge and Dominic Sparks, led by one of our colleagues, Mike Weeks, to talk about their screening program for healthcare workers in CUH. I'm actually going to start with a super brief update this week because I thought you'd had enough of my voice last week. Essentially, the national picture is unchanged. Cases continue to decline, but slowly. But obviously, the main news is that the government is starting to enact its ever so slow lifting of lockdown plan. And so there's a headline in the top left, cars from cross countries in gridlock. There's a message that I got this morning from a friend in Cambridge who went for a run on Lammas land, lots of people in big groups, kissing, hugging. And then the picture at the bottom was sent to me by Paul Lehner. Actually, I think he must be sent to him by someone else because I don't think he was on Southend Beach yesterday. This is obviously slightly ominous signs, but we'll have to see whether these increased outdoor activities feed through into more cases over the next 2 or 3 weeks. So on that note, I'm going to actually hand straight over to Matt to start the healthcare worker presentation.
Thanks, Nick. So as mentioned, so my name's Mackie Routledge and I'm here with my colleague Dominic Sparks. So we're two of the infectious disease registrars and we're presenting on behalf of Mike Weeks. So the first thing to say is that we're presenting not just on behalf of Mike Weeks, but also a huge team. So this work has come out of the CITID NIHR COVID-19 bioresource collaboration. As you can see, there's been a huge number of people involved. But most notably, this work has been done as a collaboration between the Infectious Disease Department under the direction of Mike Weeks, the lab of Steve Baker, who've been doing most of the actual testing, and then also the Virology Department under the direction of Professor Ian Goodfellow. So the general overview of the talk is, I'm going to talk in the first half about some of the background literature and essentially hopefully impress upon you why it's not a good idea to just test symptomatic healthcare workers if we're really realistically going to reduce transmission within hospital. I'm then going to hand over to Dom, who's going to speak about the sort of specifics of the program and some of the results that we've had so far. So I'd start with this paper that was published in the middle of March in the New England Journal of Medicine of a study that was performed in Guangdong province in China. So they took 18 patients who had SARS-CoV-2 infection and serially swabbed them from their throat and nose and plotted the CT values that they obtained using real-time PCR. And what they showed quite nicely is that from the day of the onset of symptoms, the CT values tended to decline. And what they hypothesized was that actually at the point of symptom onset is roughly when you must have the highest level of virus, or potentially you actually have higher levels of virus pre-symptomatically. And this was one of the first studies that really highlighted the potential for pre-symptomatic transmission. Just to contrast this with what we see in the original SARS outbreak, so this is a paper from 2003, And so if you do essentially the same thing, what you can see is that in the original SARS, your viral loads appear to peak at about day 10. So it's a very different relationship. And actually, although it may appear on the first glance as though this is a rather niche point, actually I think it probably is one of the defining differences between SARS and SARS-CoV-2, and helps to explain why SARS-CoV-2 has been a much more difficult epidemic to control. At the start of April, there was this paper that was published in Nature, which I think probably many of you are familiar with by now. This was performed in Germany, in Munich. They had 9 patients who were all generally young and healthy admitted to their local hospital and diagnosed with SARS-CoV-2. Again, they performed sort of serial PCR on throat swab and nasopharyngeal swab over the course of their illness, but also additionally took sputum and stool samples. And as you can see, it's a very similar relationship as to what was seen in the first paper. Crucially, what they did in this paper, though, was actually attempt to try and culture the virus. And rather strikingly, they showed that actually beyond day 8 of symptom onset, they were unable to actually culture virus. So despite the fact that we now know that people can shed RNA for up to, well, at least 37 days, I think is in the highest limit in the current literature, actually it appears that it's incredibly difficult to culture virus beyond about day 8. And so that has important implications for trying to work out infectivity. There's also additional been follow-up studies, including some unpublished data from PHE, which suggests, again, that it's they were unable to culture virus beyond day 9 of symptoms. One of the only other studies that actually involved culturing virus was this study from an outbreak in a care home in Washington State. And so what happened in this study was they did a point prevalence swabbing of all the residents in the care home who had at the time of the outbreak, and then followed them up 7 days later. So at the first time point, they had a huge number of residents who had no symptoms at all, but then found after 7 days that a large number of them had gone on to develop symptoms. So they called these the pre-symptomatic group. And you can see there that actually when they cultured virus, attempted to culture virus from that first time point, they were actually readily able to culture viable virus from this pre-symptomatic group. Again, really emphasizing that it is that they have very, despite the fact that these residents at the time had no symptoms, they clearly were infected with viable virus and potentially were able to infect other members of the community. This next paper really emphasizes, so there have been limited studies in terms that have actually involved the culture of virus, which has really limited our understanding of the viral transmission dynamics. This paper, though, was one of the first that tried to do this epidemiologically. So this was a paper that came out of Gabriel Lung's group from the University of Hong Kong. So again, they had a large number of patients that they swabbed. And again, they saw the same relationship in CT values with a gradual decline from day zero post-symptom onset down to a level of detectability on average about day 21. What they did importantly was tried to model the infectivity of this using an epidemiological method. So if you want to do this epidemiologically, you need to know two things essentially. So you need to know the incubation period of the infection. So in SARS-CoV-2, we think it's somewhere between 5 to 7 days. And then the other measure that you need to try and work out is a measure known as the serial interval. So you need to imagine that you've got two people that are in a fixed environment together. One who is your primary case, who presumably gets infected at day zero. They incubate that virus, say, for 7 days. And at that point, they have their onset of symptoms. The interval between that first case's onset of symptoms and then the second person in that fixed environment developing symptoms is what's known as your serial interval. And basically, the relationship between your incubation period and serial interval tells you when it's likely that that infection was actually passed. So this cartoon illustrates that. So in scenario one, where you have a serial interval which is exactly the same as your incubation period, what that tells you is that probably the peak of infectivity was at the point of symptom onset for the primary case. So for example, if the primary case develops symptoms at day 7 and then the secondary case develops symptoms at day 14, you can guess that probably the infection was transmitted at the point of symptom onset. In scenario 2, what happens is you have a longer serial interval than your incubation period. And what that suggests is that actually the peak of infectiousness is beyond the onset of symptoms of that primary case. So I'll go on to it. I'll give you an example of this. The final scenario is when the serial interval is actually shorter than the incubation period. And what that suggests is that there's significant pre-symptomatic transmission. So these are a couple of examples of other illnesses in which this has been done. So you can see that in the original SARS outbreak, you had a longer serial interval than you have an incubation period. And what that suggests is that the peak of infectivity is actually during the symptomatic period of the primary case. And again, that really fits in nicely with those CT values I showed you early on, where you had a peak of infectivity about day 10 post onset of symptoms. This explains why actually it was relatively straightforward to control the original SARS outbreak, because essentially if you isolate patients at the point of symptom onset and prevent them from transmitting to anyone else, you can arrest the further transmission quite easily. On the right is an example of what you see in influenza. So actually the serial interval of influenza is about the same or actually slightly shorter than the incubation period. And what that suggests, again, is that there is a small amount of pre-symptomatic transmission. So in SARS-CoV-2, if you do this, and this paper did this by getting 77 pairs of people that they were convinced had one had infected the other, and try and work out their serial interval, you can model what you think the viral transmission dynamics are like. So if you do this with SARS-CoV-2, you get this graph. And essentially what they showed was that, in their estimates, 44% or roughly half of secondary cases were infected during the index cases pre-symptomatic stage. And this has major implications for the control of the epidemic, because essentially what it means is that if you isolate patients at the point at which they become symptomatic, you probably can't reduce the number of secondary cases below the R0 value of 1. Why is this important if you're trying to set up a healthcare worker screening program? So I've just put superimposed on that graph just some sort of hypothetical time point for a program that is based purely on testing symptomatic healthcare workers. And so as you can see, the whole process takes quite a long period. From the point at which the healthcare worker becomes symptomatic, it maybe takes a day or so for them to phone up occupational health. If you have a delay then to when they actually become swabbed, if you have a further delay into when the sample arrives in the lab and is processed, you can see quite easily how actually by the time that you get either a positive result or even one that identify a cluster of infections that enables you to put infection control measures in, you've actually massively missed the boat in terms of reducing the risk of onward transmission in secondary cases. So the overall aim of a healthcare worker screening program should be to push all of these steps to the left, and that will essentially involve screening asymptomatic healthcare workers. And obviously also the other thing is to try and minimize the gaps between these steps. So the problems with current screening programs are not just to do with the chronology of the infection, but also the symptomatology. So it's increasingly becoming apparent that the sort of classical symptoms of fever, persistent cough, and now anosmia actually has been moved into the sort of major criteria, pick up a percentage of the infections, but probably a small number than we originally appreciated. So if you have a screening program that is only going to test people that have classical symptoms, you're probably going to miss a large number of cases. So at the point at which we performed our study, there was only a couple of other publications from UK centres that had involve screening of healthcare workers. And both of these centres only screened highly symptomatic healthcare workers. So screening people based on symptomatic grounds does have some advantages. So it means obviously that you need less testing capacity, as you don't require regular screening of many more people. It obviously has the advantage that there are a lot of people that have symptoms who, as it turns out, don't actually have SARS-CoV-2. And if you can test those people earlier, find out they're negative and get them back to work faster, then that has massive implications for the workforce. It also gives symptomatic healthcare workers the knowledge that they've had the infection, which obviously has some psychological benefits. But of the clear disadvantages is that, as I mentioned, you're going to miss the potential to reduce the number of secondary cases, because half of the secondary cases will have been infected during the pre-symptomatic period. You're likely to miss many of the cases based on the symptomatology. And actually, probably the whole process would be too slow to realistically impact on infection control precautions. So I'm going to hand over now to Dom, who's going to talk a bit about the screening program as it operates, and then also some of our early results.
Great, thanks Matt. So with our screening program, we had two separate arms, the symptomatic healthcare workers, which included household contacts, and also the asymptomatic healthcare workers that Matt has been discussing. Starting with the symptomatic healthcare workers, the entry into this program was via the symptomatic healthcare worker calling occupational health and then booking an appointment in one of the swabbing pods. Nationally, the advice for who to test was based on at this time persistent cough, which means sort of a cough over 4 hours, or a fever. However, at this time, we felt this was too prescriptive. And after reviewing the literature, designed our own slightly more comprehensive criteria, which I'm going to show here. But we developed major and minor criteria for symptoms. The major symptoms included the governmental criteria, with the addition of unprotected close contact with a confirmed case. And we also had 10 minor criteria, including other associated symptoms from the literature, including at this point anosmia, sore throat and myalgia. We then deemed people as high, medium or low risk based on these symptoms. So a high probability required greater or equal to 2 major symptoms, or 1 major plus 2 minor. A medium probability was 1 major or no major and at least 3 minor symptoms. A low probability was no major and 1 to 2 minor symptoms. So all staff who contacted occupational health were invited for screening, and all were excluded from work until a result was known. So then for the asymptomatic healthcare workers, we went to the wards to collect the samples. We targeted the wards we thought were likely to have a higher rate of COVID-19. In Addenbrooke's wards, colour coordinated into red, amber and green, like this. So red wards have patients who have tested positive for SARS-CoV-2. Amber wards have cases where the diagnosis has not yet been confirmed, so possibly have SARS-CoV-2. And green wards have patients who have tested negative for SARS-CoV-2. We hypothesised that staff would be at a greater risk on wards with confirmed or possible SARS-CoV-2, and therefore we prioritised these wards initially. However, we also tested some green wards with very vulnerable patients, for example, the haematology patients. And also, when concerns were raised by infection controls teams, we screened staff to help them investigate. Testing from both arms required self-swabbing of the throat and the nasal cavity, using the same swab for both. The swab was immediately placed into a transport medium containing a guanidine-based lysis buffer to inactivate the virus, and this allowed processing in a CAT2 lab. We had real-time PCR amplification and used a threshold cycle of less than 36 for positivity. This was done in Steve Baker's lab. The positive results were phoned out by an infectious diseases registrar who discussed the results with the healthcare workers. During this consultation, a detailed history of symptoms, if any, were then taken. We retrospectively applied the probability criteria. Advice was also given at this stage as when they needed to return to work. The negative results were emailed out by occupational health with the advice that if they had low probability symptoms, they could go back to work. However, if they had medium probability symptoms, we required them to have a repeat swab 48 hours later before returning. And if they had high probability symptoms, they were to complete their 7 days of isolation, even though they had a negative test result. Our return to work policy for particularly positive healthcare workers was based on PHE guidance at the time, which is shown here. It's a bit of a busy slide. It recommends 7 days from the time of swab that was taken to isolate, providing the healthcare worker was 48 hours fever-free before returning. We made some slight adjustments to this because we were having asymptomatic people. If it was a very clear date of symptom onset with a high probability of COVID, we advised 7 days from symptom onset, which was at the time in line with the current national advice if people had not been tested. So if they had just had symptoms and were, they would advise to be off for 7 days. For the truly asymptomatic healthcare workers, we advised 7 days from swab or the onset of symptoms if they developed them at a later date to account for any pre-symptomatic cases. I'm now going to move on to discuss the results from our first 3 weeks of testing, which we've recently published in eLife. So in the first 3 weeks, at the beginning of April, we performed 1,270 tests. There are two failures, both of these tests were repeated. We tested 1,032 in the asymptomatic screening arm and 221 in the symptomatic screening arm, and that included both symptomatic staff and symptomatic household contacts. So these are the key results. Within the asymptomatic arm, 31 out of the 1,032 healthcare workers were positive for SARS-CoV-2. Within the symptomatic arm, 30 out of the 221 were positive. Unsurprisingly, symptomatic healthcare workers were significantly more likely to be positive than asymptomatic healthcare workers. Interestingly, healthcare workers working in red or amber wards were significantly more likely to test positive than those in green wards, which you can see here, clearly in the asymptomatic group. There are many explanations for this observation, and we couldn't differentiate between them from our data. Some of the possible explanations include transmission between patients and healthcare workers, which we sort of hypothesized at the beginning, healthcare worker to healthcare worker transmission, variability of staff exposure outside of the workplace, and also non-random selection of the wards. It's also possible that even over the 3 weeks of the study, red wards were sampled slightly earlier during the evolution of the epidemic, when transmission was greater. It is clearly of interest and something that required more investigation. So from now on, I'm now going to mainly focus on the asymptomatic healthcare workers. As discussed earlier, we took detailed histories from each positive case and retrospectively applied the probability criteria and when or if they had symptoms. So this pie chart shows a breakdown of all the asymptomatic cases. There was one asymptomatic healthcare worker we were unable to contact for a history, although they were prevented from working by occupational health. The middle pie chart shows when the healthcare workers had symptoms, if at all. So 40% over here had symptoms more than 7 days ago. Of these, 75% of the cases had already self-isolated and returned to work. This pie chart over here shows the breakdown of the symptoms of their symptoms on retrospective analysis. The majority here had sort of high probability symptoms. Another 40% over on this side had some symptoms within the last 7 days, again with their probability shown in the side pie chart. All of these staff were at work, and you can clearly see a bigger variety of symptoms. And probably most interesting of all, 20% were completely asymptomatic at the time of swabbing. So overall, within the asymptomatic arm, 57% of cases were either asymptomatic or poorly symptomatic. Within the asymptomatic screening group, we identified 19 wards for screening as part of our hospital-wide surveillance. As discussed before, this is a mixture of red and green wards, as you can see here. Two further areas were specifically targeted for screening due to an unusually high staff sickness rates, which is ward F on this graph, or concerns regarding appropriate PPE, which is ward Q on this graph. As you can see, in line with findings in the total healthcare worker population, a significantly greater proportion of healthcare workers working on red wards compared to healthcare workers working on green wards tested positive as part of the asymptomatic screening. The proportion of healthcare workers with a positive test was significantly higher on ward F than on the other wards classified as green, and likewise significantly higher on Q compared to the other the red wards. we defined these events as clusters. So we went on to investigate these wards a little bit further. So Ward F was a green elderly care ward, and four out of 43 staff tested positive in our initial screen. A further two staff members tested positive as part of the symptomatics arm, which you can see here. Ward Q was a red general medicine ward. 7 out of the 37 healthcare workers tested positive, with one further positive case in the symptomatic screening arm. When we found this, we decided to complete a full screen of both wards, all staff that worked on these wards in the last 14 days. When we did this, we found a further 3 positive cases on Ward F and a further 1 case on Ward Q. Again, that's shown as the yellow in this figure. For both wards, all positive healthcare workers were requested to self-isolate, and infection control and PPE reviews were undertaken to ensure that environmental cleaning and PPE donning and doffing practices were compliant with hospital protocol. Staff training and education was provided to address any incorrect infection control or PPE practice. The identification of the clusters and the swift intervention when found shows the necessity of having a comprehensive screening program, including both the asymptomatic and symptomatic healthcare workers, and also the real importance of linking in with the hospital to try and rectify these problems. And it's an approach that's likely to be highly significant over the coming months as the lockdown eases. Just moving on to some of the genomics. So samples with a CT value of less than 30 underwent whole genome sequencing. The majority of the cases belong to a lineage B.1, which is circulating in at least 43 countries, which is shown here. All 4 sequenced viruses on Q ward were on this lineage. Other positives on that ward had a higher CT value to be processed. On Ward F, 6 out of the 9 samples were from B.1, 2 belonged to B.1.7 and 1 to B.2.1. It's difficult to link cases based purely on their genomics without epidemiological data to go with it due to the slow mutation rate and the small SNP differences, but it is likely that there were more than one introduction of SARS-CoV-2 onto Ward F. Okay. I'm now going to move on to some of our data since the paper was published. So firstly, this is another study which was performed in Barts, where they looked at 400 healthcare workers across a 5-week period during the epidemic. The left y-axis shows the number of new daily cases in London, and the right y-axis shows the percentage of asymptomatic healthcare workers with positive swabs. The x-axis shows the number of weeks. Their data suggested that the number of positive cases declined with the epidemic curve in London. They suggested that the rate of asymptomatic infection among healthcare workers more likely reflects general community transmission than in-hospital transmission. I think we've clearly shown that it is likely there are examples of in-hospital transmission with the illustration of clusters, and in-hospital transmission like this could allow hospitals to harbour disease and also prolong the epidemic. So I'm now going to show some of the local data. So this is the epidemic curve in Addenbrookes with the number of confirmed cases by swab date since the 10th of March. Clearly you can see the number of positive patients is declining, and this is despite increased testing over this period. Here you can see the healthcare worker data. The dark blue line shows the percentage of positive symptomatic tests, and the light blue is for asymptomatic tests. As you can see, both percentages fall dramatically over the weeks from the 6th of April, which was probably the peak of the epidemic. Despite increasing the testing numbers, as seen in the bars, the number of cases has fallen down to having no cases at all the week before last and only 2 cases so far this week. Sorry, no cases last week and only 2 so far this week. This is a similar finding to the Barts paper, and it certainly implies that the epidemic has eased with the measures put in place both locally and nationally. So, question is this a reason to be optimistic? Well, clearly it is, but with a caveat. This is a graph shown by Nick Matheson last week, showing some modelling from the Imperial Group. It relates to intensive care cases, but gives a good pictorial representation of the likely trajectory of the disease if no vaccine is produced as lockdown is eased and reinforced. It's very likely we're about to see a second raise in cases both in the community, and therefore likely in the hospital. Given that what we have found in the modelling of future rises in cases, it is clear that continuing a comprehensive staff screening programme, including both symptomatic and asymptomatic arms, is vital to reduce transmission in hospitals and to protect both staff and patients. So to conclude, our sort of take-home messages are that we found 3% of asymptomatic staff screened for SARS-CoV-2 were positive whilst at work. 57% of these were poorly symptomatic or truly asymptomatic. We identified clusters of cases which allowed swift intervention by the hospital to reduce further transmission. More encouragingly, the number of cases is reducing with the epidemic curve locally. However, with the easing of the lockdown and the likely second wave of infections, a regular asymptomatic staff screening program is essential for controlling SARS-CoV-2 infection within a hospital. I'd just like to take this opportunity again just to thank everybody who was involved in this project. So I'll leave that slide up.
Great, thanks, Dominic. So let's see if there's any questions for you in the chat. I'm just going to start with one of my own. And so what's your sort of take-home message to PHE from this? It's all very well screening in Cambridge, but what's the... How do you think UK government should be acting on this data?
So I think it is important, and it is clear that asymptomatic screening is important, and that if we should actively encourage hospitals to offer an asymptomatic screening if at all possible. Obviously there are some caveats, and the actual total numbers of tests that people are capable of doing has to be taken into consideration. So although in an ideal world you would screen people asymptomatic people as regularly as you can, it will be dependent slightly on the number of testing, which is why I think increasing testing capabilities is such an important factor.
Do you want to add anything to that, Mike?
I entirely agree. I think prioritised testing, particularly directed testing, whereby if you have low capacity, you direct your tests, as we started off doing, according to the staff sickness patterns, the wards where people test positive through the symptomatic stream. That's very important. And then everywhere developing asymptomatic screening programs is going to be very important, particularly for the next bump or wave.
So question in the chat, what's the limiting factor in Addenbrookes for testing? Who wants to take that?
Sure.
Matt?
So I think there are a few limiting factors. I mean, so one is staffing. So a huge number of the frontline staff who've been involved in the pods and the ward-based screening have obviously come from other projects and other areas of work. So I think one of the challenges to the sustainability of the program is to ensure kind of that we maintain our staff levels or even possibly expand them. Because actually the screening program is actually quite labour intensive. So that's one of the key factors. Likewise, laboratory capacity. So all of this work has been done through Steve Baker's lab in CITID as opposed to the PHE lab in the main hospital. Because obviously the PHE lab has a huge amount of demand on it already from all of the testing that's being done for patients, both within CUH but also regionally. So again, expanding lab capacity and staffing, they're the real things that limit our capacity currently.
And so in terms of using capacity, what's your view about doing the same sort of thing in care homes, Dominic?
I actually think it would be quite a useful thing to be doing, because there's a huge number of care homes that have already got infections in them. And they're obviously a particularly at-risk group. So trying to find people in a care home early before they have an opportunity to spread it further would be really important. So actually, I think that'd be a really, really key thing to try and move into. So I think something that public health should definitely be looking into, and I think they are doing.
A couple of people have asked about false negative rates. Do you want to comment on that, Matt?
I think there are naturally sort of concerns about testing using nasopharyngeal swabs in general with SARS-CoV-2. And I think there are two kind of issues. There's the clinical sensitivity and the analytical sensitivity. So I think the main concern is that essentially through swabbing and through self-swabbing, you might be concerned that people don't actually pick up a virus and you get a falsely reassuring negative result. I mean, I think in general, the approach that we've taken has been fairly pragmatic. So for people that have got severe symptoms, we have not been taking a single negative result as reassuring, and have usually essentially either retested or just advised to complete the necessary isolation period. In terms of the false negatives that we get from the asymptomatic screening arm, I mean, I think they are inevitably, we are inevitably going to miss a few cases. But I suppose in that group of healthcare workers, if we weren't screening at all, they would still be at work. So I don't think actually anything has been lost.
I'm going to take one more question, but I'm just going to ask one of my own to Mike first. So the declining frequency of positive tests suggests that this is that you're mainly seeing community-acquired infections amongst healthcare workers. Is that right?
Probably, yes. I mean, there's obviously lots of factors at play here. So it could be that the patients are giving it to the healthcare workers and there's fewer patients coming into hospital, so there's less transmission like that. It could be that many of the healthcare workers we've screened actually live with other healthcare workers, and so that's another sort of inverted commas community-based transmission that is a possibility that nevertheless could stem from the hospital. And so the declining number of healthcare worker transmissions, I suppose, implies that the hospital hasn't become a hub. And going back to the care home question, I suppose the possibility of healthcare institutions becoming independent hubs of transmission as community transmission dies down is something that we should take very seriously. But I suppose the reassuring thing is that that hasn't happened, and that probably at least partly reflects the very good infection control procedures that we have at Addenbrookes, and the sort of multidisciplinary input from multiple different teams, including virology, infection control, infectious diseases, occupational health.
Thanks. I was going to say the fact you found clusters of infections is I guess your best evidence for in-hospital transmission, combined with the consistent genomics. So last question, but it's in two parts. I'm actually going to direct it to you as well, Mike. So firstly, question one is there a role for the point of care test in screening healthcare workers? And then point two, what's the role of antibody testing in healthcare workers?
So I suppose a point of care test would be ideal, because obviously the faster the turnaround, the faster you can identify somebody who is positive and the faster you can isolate them. Our turnaround times are, depending on the time of day you have your swab, between 12 to 36 hours, which is pretty good. But obviously with the Samba machines the hospital has and uses in certain groups, the turnaround time, if you get straight onto the machine, is 2 hours. And so if we had a huge array of them all dedicated towards healthcare worker testing, although the cost would be greater, that would give you faster, that would improve your turnaround times. And then in terms of the role of antibody testing, clearly it looks like we have some developing very good, very sensitive and specific serological assays, but the problem is at the moment that we don't necessarily know whether testing positive for antibody means that you are actually immune. Can you become reinfected? Can you become transiently infected in your nasopharynx and still shed virus and transmit to other people? And the duration of immunity is another unknown as well. Personally, I suspect that the duration may reflect the severity of the initial illness. So if you have a transient common cold-like illness, you may not develop high-level antibody or long-lasting immunity, whereas if you have much more of a flu-like illness, as per the evidence for long-lasting immunity to flu, you may develop a longer-lasting, more protective immunity.
Excellent. All right, I'm going to call it today there. So thanks very much to Dominic, Matt and Mike. So next week, I promise we won't be talking about asymptomatic transmission again. And so it's actually going to be a tour of the histopathology of SARS-CoV-2, which I think is a really important subject that and it's one that we take for granted in other diseases that have been around for a lot longer. So I'm looking forward to that. Please do join us next Thursday.